From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, how the changes in Milwaukee's taxi and ride industry are driven by technology. Later, why a Milwaukee man is taking some of his high school students to the climate march.
My work is around helping young leaders to develop. Taking 10 kids to New York for this march will certainly give them an idea of the power that they can harness by working with a group of people to tackle these issues.
Dave Lurson has a fall movie preview, and Milwaukee's Fine Arts Quartet plays a piece in which 8 of the 9 movements are slow.
It consists of 9 movements, 8 of which are slow. That was one of the requirements of the canon or priest who commissioned the work. And even Haydn, the great master, was very upset about this. How do you create enough variety in those 7 movements to make it interesting for the public?
Lake Effect is next, after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The City of Milwaukee's License Division is continuing to accept applications from prospective taxi operators. That comes after a judge last week refused to issue an injunction keeping a new ordinance from going into place to lift the city's cap on taxicab permits. Opponents of that ordinance have filed a lawsuit seeking to overturn it. Proponents had claimed the previous caps had amounted to a monopoly protecting a few drivers. The new ordinance also paves the way for ride services such as Uber and Lyft to operate above board in Milwaukee. The cover story in today's Milwaukee Business Journal makes the case that these ride services have been a game changer here for riders and for the industry. Writer Allison Botter joins us regularly to talk about business and technology, and she's with us now to talk about how they're intersecting on the roads. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
Is this, strictly speaking, a business story or a technology story, or can you separate the two?
I think it's a little bit of both. It's a business competition being driven, not to make a pun there, but being driven by technology and rapidly changing technology there.
Well, and so is the change being driven by the technology, or is the demand driving the technology to make the change?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that, you know, in Milwaukee, there's been this cap on the taxi cabs for the longest time. And the cabbies themselves are saying, hey, well, there's really not that much demand, so it doesn't make sense to lift this cap. But what these new tech-driven companies coming in are finding is that people are using mobile apps, using smartphone technology, and they're getting plenty of rides, plenty of use. So the demand is clearly there, and the technology kind of brings it to light.
The supply is going up and the demand is going up all at the same time.
That's what it would look like, yeah.
Well, so let me ask a very basic question here. What is it that these ride services, we're talking mainly Uber and Lyft here, what do they offer that people increasingly like versus what traditional cab companies have always offered?
Right. So Lyft and Uber are making it possible to have a smartphone app that's going to link up, in this case, with your Facebook profile and tell you when your ride is coming, how much it will cost, and all these things kind of in an upfront, transparent way, especially for younger users. A lot of them in Milwaukee are the college-age Marquette, UWM students. They really like that kind of conveniency, transparency, and the simplicity that comes with it. I think part of the challenge is that for taxis, there's a sense that, that they're not available when the students need them, that they are, you know, catering to the airport, the Pfister, that kind of area. That may not be as true as they think. There certainly are apps available for those taxis, much like the ones for Lyft and Uber. I think it's a matter of, as I say in this week's cover story in the Business Journal, kind of winning over those hearts and minds and, you know, getting to be top of mind when someone opens up their smartphone and wants to use an app to get somewhere.
The cab companies still believe that there are things on their side, even as the cap on the licenses was lifted. What is it that cabs say they offer that they don't believe you can get from one of these ride services?
Right. So there's a lot of things the cabs are saying. Ali Muhammad, who owns the Yellow Cab Co-op, he makes the simple case that, like, well, one thing they've got going for them is color. You know a cab when you see it. You're able to just put your hand out, hail it. You don't need to take out a smartphone or even own one to get a ride. Additionally, you know, they make the case that, look, they know the town. they have these clean, well-taken-care-of cars, etc. So there's definitely, you know, both sides are kind of forced to make their case at this point as the competition is changing.
Well, and a lot has been made about the unconventional ways the two big ride service companies, Uber and Lyft, do their advertising. And by and large, cabs have always just done their advertising by being visible.
Right. Yeah. And it's a pretty simple concept there, right? Whereas Uber and Lyft, you know, you're going to see them all over Twitter, all over Facebook. And on Lyft's side, what you'll see is those big pink fuzzy mustaches on the cars you've probably seen downtown and around. That's their mobile advertisement.
You mentioned that the rub that cab companies, rightly or wrongly, have had on them is where they're located, airports, hotels, and events in the downtown corridor. What is it that the ride service companies say they offer in terms of location?
Well, in terms of location, the idea is that you don't need to be in these kind of downtown spots. In fact, a lot of cabs do tend to avoid the north side. And so the pitch that these rideshares are making is, look, we're going to be on the north side, we're going to be downtown, and you can, you know, get us – Uber likes to advertise within 4 minutes from anywhere downtown using that mobile app.
They have had to kind of go to some lengths to convince people that getting a ride from Uber or Lyft is a safe and secure kind of experience, and vice versa. The drivers who participate want to know something about their riders as well.
Right. And this is part of the newness of Lyft and Uber's approach. Using, like I said, the Facebook profile, what they do is they rate anyone who rides in the in Lyft or Uber. Likewise, the riders are rating the drivers. So ideally, you know, it's tracking where you're going. You've got this, social media, this kind of profile information out there. So what they're pitching is, hey, you're actually safer here. You know, there's accountability. If someone's not getting rated highly, you're not going to take a ride with that person.
Moreover, there's often no cash that's changing hands, right?
Right. And many cabs are switching to this as well. But what you're seeing with these apps is that people just put their credit card information in, and you're never going to be swiping any plastic. You're never going to, you know, have to run over to an ATM and get $20, which, again, is one of their part of their pitch, them saying that this is us being a little safer, a little easier.
Well, and so is this likely the direction that this industry is going, regardless of who you get your ride from? Are we likely to see the traditional cab services start to look much more like the ride services?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, most of those cab services do have those apps in hand right now. The interface might not be quite so smooth as Uber or Lyft, but again, they've got several $1 million in fundraising out in California that they're putting into this technology.
Do we have any way of quantifying the impact these ride services have already had in Milwaukee beyond the obvious point that they were a catalyst for lifting the caps?
Beyond that obvious point, I would say most of it's anecdotal. It's a lot of, you know, talking. You see that taxi line at the Pfister, for example. Talking to people over there, they're saying, well, you know, there used to be kind of a pecking order. People wait in line in their cabs. They pick up a fare. They go. Now you're going to see, you know, an Uber come in and pick someone up. You're going to see a Lyft stop by. And all of a sudden, that system's a little bit changed. In addition to that, it's talking to especially, again, this kind of younger demographic, and you can see where the interest is going on that side very clearly, and unfortunately for the cabs, it's not in their direction.
Speaking of the demographic, you read a sidebar in this story about a firm called Startup Milwaukee and one of the people behind that firm. How do they fit into this picture?
Right. So one of the things that Uber and Lyft did very early on when they came to the city was they partnered with Startup Milwaukee and tried to kind of ingrain themselves in, again, that kind of young smartphone tech-savvy demographic. And they also have, according to Matt Cordio, who's over there at 96 Square, the co-working space, a lot of the entrepreneurs over there are working part-time and, you know, giving people a couple rides using Lyft and making some money on the side.
Well, and so is that the typical demographic, if you will, of an Uber or Lyft driver, is someone who does it, you know, on an as-needed, as-available kind of basis?
Well, anecdotally and according to the companies, there is quite a range. There's people who are retired. There are stay-at-home moms. There's, you know, teachers, young people, old, whatever it might be. There is quite a range, and it's really anyone who has the qualifications and the right kind of car and, you know, pays the fee can supposedly do this.
So do we know how much they're making on you know, like a typical person might make driving for Uber or Lyft?
That's hard to say. It depends on the day, from what the drivers have said. Sometimes in a week or so, they'll make about $400. Sometimes they will make little to nothing. It depends how often they're driving and when they're out.
Have you taken one of these services yourself?
I did, actually, for the Business Journal a month or so back. We did a comparison where I rode in with a couple of my coworkers, rode in each of these down to the Colectivo in Humboldt. And we went back and forth. And honestly, it was sort of hard to pick a standout. You know, it was all actually pretty good service.
Well, Allison Botter, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
Allison Botter covers technology and innovation for the Milwaukee Business Journal, and she's a Lake Effect contributor. She wrote the cover story on rideshare services like Uber and Lyft that's in today's issue. There's a link from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Keep listening. After a break, among the hundreds of thousands of people who are expected to march this weekend in New York to demand action on climate change will be some Milwaukeeans. We'll meet half a dozen of them when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Several busloads of people are heading out to New York City from Milwaukee. Theirs is not a Broadway theater tour or a Metropolitan Museum of Art extravaganza. The group is joining in what organizers estimate will be a throng of 500,000 marchers who will fill Manhattan streets Sunday to draw attention to climate change. Organizers of what's being called the People's Climate March say the effort is bringing together over 1,100 organizations from around the world. Their goal is to generate national and international pressure as the United Nations convenes a climate summit on Tuesday. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bent spoke with several people preparing to head to New York City. They share their perspectives, but first they introduce themselves.
I'm Alexander Molzon. I'm a freshman at UWM.
I'm George Martin. I'm a leader in the national international peace movement, and we have come to join into this march in conference and in bringing peace and the climate crisis together.
Hi, I'm Devin Capari, and I'm one of the bus organizers for the September 21st Climate March.
I'm Wendell Harris. I'm first vice president of the Wisconsin Conference, NAACP. And as we all know, I hope, that the NAACP nationally has declared clean environment pollution of our communities as a civil rights issue, and we're fighting to help move this issue forward. And that's my role, as well as working with young people at Transition High School, and we'll be taking a number of young people too, so they can have the experience of learning how to fight this fight to clean up our environment.
I'm Terry Wiggins. I'm going to be marching with the People of Faith on September 21st at the People's Climate March. I'm a member of First Unitarian Society of Milwaukee and also a member of the Interfaith Earth Network.
Julie Enslow. I'm with 350.org Milwaukee. The largest march in history around a social issue was in 1982 when over 1 million people gathered in New York to call for total nuclear disarmament at the time of a UN meeting. And so at that point, we organized 13 busloads from Milwaukee. I was there with my oldest daughter at the time, and here we are again in 2014 with another incredible crisis on our hands that needs tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets in order to really draw attention to this and to try to get some action from our world leaders. So once again in New York City, this time they're aiming for 500,000 people around the whole climate change issue.
Throughout your life, that's been among the key issues that has driven you to activism, to taking a stand and speaking out and marching.
Well, I've always been involved in nuclear disarmament, which is the ultimate environmental issue. I mean, that will really do us in. And so there's this connection all along with war and militarism and the environmental damages and the amount of pollution that the military has dumped on the planet, whether it's toxic wastes or the CO2 emissions from the excessive use of fossil fuels. And so there's this connection with the militarism contributing to climate change, and global warming. If it continues at the rate it is, we're going to have mass chaos on this planet. Migrations of people, these climate refugees, we already have them in Africa in particular. When you have these mass migrations, it creates chaos. Water wars, we already are having oil wars. We've had oil wars for years, and other resources that will be at risk of running out, such as arable lands and potable water, will be fought over. The Pentagon already gets it. They've been planning for this for years. They see it coming, and they have their plans in place. We need our plans in place to prevent that from happening, and that's why we're going to New York.
Let's just shift a teeny bit here. So Wendell Harris, tell me about the group of young people you're taking on this trip.
I work with young people at Transition High School. My role is to teach conflict resolution, leadership skills, life skills, and all of that is included in learning about how the political game works, learn about issues that affect our lives now, which will affect young people's lives greater, because people my age will move on and leave this mess if we don't clean it up. All my work is around helping young leaders to develop. Taking 10 kids to New York for this march will certainly give them an idea of the power that they can harness by working with a group of people to tackle these issues. I'm not coming to this whole clean up the environment issue because we're doing a march. This has been ongoing with me. We have to expose our young people to issues in their lives. When we expose them to trips like the UN and to Washington, D.C. for different causes, we get leaders.
People say, why do we go to these rallies and events? And one, we go to learn more. Two, we go to get connected. Three, we come back with energy to do the work. And we were all young, and at one time when I was 16, I was 10 feet from Dr. King when he gave his I Have a Dream speech with 250,000 people. That experience is just unbelievable in terms of how it opened my eyes and broadened. People don't have an idea of the magnitude of this kind of thing. But also being with that number of people who want the same thing that you want, it's an absolutely wonderful experience, and we just encourage anybody who can to get there.
So, Alex, what a whirlwind you've jumped into. You're a freshman at UWM. What are you studying?
Sustainability. So I first got involved with the whole environmental aspect through Boy Scouts, because that's where I started going outside, camping, seeing the beauty of nature. You know, we went to the Apostle Islands, we went to Fairmont Scout Ranch. Beautiful wilderness areas. You can look in other nations where these natures have been destroyed for the resources. That's what kind of gave me the whole climate change aspect of it. Just the destruction's been wrought and how the beauty's been destroyed.
Terry, this isn't the first of your trips, your marches. Talk a bit about what informs where you are in this discussion.
I have been a Bill McKibben groupie, I guess, since 2007 when he organized Step It Up rallies all over the country, and I helped organize one. It's really since that time that my activism has focused on climate change as being the most important element of what we needed to do to preserve our humanity all over the world, and not only our humanity, but all of life, all of the interdependent web of life. That's really where I'm coming from, is preserving the interdependent web for all of our sakes, for all forms of life. And I think it's so important that we show our strength.
What gives me hope with the challenge that we face is that we have the solutions. We have solar power. We have wind power. We know that that will be the transition that will get us off fossil fuels. It's right there. It's getting less expensive every day. It's no longer an issue of price. What the issue is political power, is will, and that's what people bring to the table. That's what we're going to bring on Sunday, September 21st, to New York City.
WUWM's Susan Bent spoke with six Milwaukee area people who will be among the projected 500,000 at the Climate Change March in New York City on Sunday, known as the People's Climate March. The march comes ahead of the UN Climate Summit on Tuesday in New York. We'll learn more about that event on Monday's show. Another quick break now, and then we'll return with a preview of the fall movie season as Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier this week, we previewed the fall art scene on stage and galleries and more around Milwaukee. Today, we turn to the big screen, which is hoping to rebound from a slow summer at the box office. Film contributor Dave Lurson joins our Dan Harmon to discuss fall movies, which are often Oscar contenders, as movie companies hope they're the freshest in the minds of awards voters. Dave Lurson talks about just how bad it was for movies this summer.
By some reports, Hollywood had its worst summer in 8 years, with ticket sales down 15% to 20% in the U.S. Some multiplexes in Milwaukee have actually cut back their hours. Although the industry likes to blame digital pirating, which is certainly a factor, maybe the underlying cause is that moviegoers have concluded that most movies aren't worth the money. Now we are entering fall, the season of quality pictures and Oscar contenders. Relief from the dog days of summer is here, we hope.
Before we talk about fall movies, I just want to ask you about digital pirating, which you just mentioned. It seems to me most digital pirating is not of new releases or summer blockbusters or anything that would keep people from going to a theater in 2 days or that same night. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like that's not the bulk of digital pirating.
I don't know where the bulk of digital pirating falls exactly. I mean, there are bootleg copies of old movies that have fallen into either public domain or some gray area. Is that digital pirating? Maybe. The kind of digital pirating of new releases that Hollywood always talks about, I would actually contend, or you could make an argument, that helps promote movies. Because really, you know, somebody sees a bit of a superhero movie of some kind and they watch it on their smartphone or wherever, they're probably not going to get the quality, or they're going to get the whole movie, maybe. But I think that really it can serve as a tantalizing bait, more or less, to draw more people of that mindset into the theaters to see the movie. So I don't know. I mean, does it keep some people home? They're satisfied watching a pirated copy of a Dark Knight movie, you know, maybe. But on the other hand, I mean, many of those movies do very well despite digital pirating, and maybe because of it in some way.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling we're going to talk about digital pirating someday or a future interview.
Good topic.
Yeah. Do you think that this fall's offerings are in any way an anecdote to the summer's kind of dismal performance?
Dismal performance as far as ticket sales?
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to see about that. A counterpart to a rebuke maybe to the low quality of many summer movies, hopefully. Again, I mean, this is the time of year that when Hollywood in particular, they stockpile quality movies as they define it and they release them, you know, beginning in September, and all of a sudden there's a huge glut of them at the end of the year, including movies that are released in a couple of theaters in Los Angeles and New York just to make the Oscar nomination deadlines. And these movies often don't make it to Milwaukee until January, February, March, maybe even April at some points.
What are some of the examples of these movies?
Well, Oscar buzz movie. Here's an interesting one, Birdman. It stars Michael Keaton as a washed-up actor from a failing superhero franchise. He wants to stage a comeback for himself on Broadway, reconnecting with his true roots as an actor. Sounds very interesting. Michael Keaton is always good. It's a movie that may even have crossover appeal of some kind. You know, classic movie fans, art house fans, and superhero movie fans might all have some reason to go to see this movie.
All right. Well, is there an example of a movie that they are very specifically targeting to a certain audience rather than trying to appeal to what you just mentioned, three different audiences?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that there's some evidence that Hollywood is thinking on multiple levels this fall. Exodus, Gods and Kings. Ridley Scott is directing a biblical epic, and suddenly after a gap of many years, there are a lot of biblical epics coming out. With Ridley Scott, an esteemed director, I mean, they're hoping to get, you know, I guess, mainstream film buffs who will want to see what Ridley Scott is doing. But they're also going to be marketing this to the evangelical Christian movie market, which has become a player out there. It's more than just a blip now. It seems to be, you know, a real, you know, flashing light on the radar screen of Hollywood. And so maybe there you have an example of two different groups of people. You have Christian Bale as Moses and Sigourney Weaver and Ben Kingsley. So people who are really interested in movies will want to see it because of all these reasons. And then you have the evangelical Christian market who will want to see it and see how Moses fares compared to their understanding of the biblical account.
Is this a combination that has any history of success or failure?
Well, you know, I'd have to check to see how well Noah did in the long run. I think Noah did well. It stirred up all kinds of controversies, you know, theological as well as aesthetic, but it got people talking, which does not happen, you know, routinely with the movies that are released in movie theaters these days.
You might argue that Da Vinci Code is in a way that genre. Not quite as targeted for the specific religious audience.
I guess, although not quite the same audience as... I mean, these things get complicated, which is maybe one of the reasons that Hollywood steered away from it for so long. You know, you don't want to automatically offend a group of people who might be the core audience for something. So you have to dance around very carefully with it, and it just creates headaches. But they seem to be more willing now to give these things a shot.
Well, what else can we expect from Hollywood this fall?
Well, here's an interesting movie, Foxcatcher. Steve Carell, unrecognizable, he's being referred to when people who have seen this movie talk about it. The unrecognizable Steve Carell as a killer. This is based on the true crime story of the 1996 murder of Olympic wrestling champion by a multimillionaire, John E. DuPont. I vaguely remember this story and the news at the time, and it's made into a movie with Steve Carell as DuPont. Gone Girl is probably kind of interesting. David Fincher, intriguing director, Zodiac, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the American remake. You have Ben Affleck in this movie based on a best-selling novel about a woman who disappears, and the husband, who is very concerned about her disappearance, comes to be the suspect in the investigation. Always intriguing. And then one other one that really kind of has me interested, Inherent Vice, based on a Thomas Pynchon novel, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson of There Will Be Blood fame with Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon. It sounds like a real film noirish kind of a thing set in Los Angeles 1970 with the Manson trial as a background to it and, you know, murder investigations, private investigators, all kinds of dark side of American life sort of things.
All right. Well, you just dusted off quite a few big names. Is that a prerequisite for Hollywood offerings in the fall?
Oh, well, big names are always helpful,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, people will go to movies sometimes because of a big name. Although I have to say that my suspicion is that the power of stars is not what it used to be. There are plenty of movies that have stars in them in the past few years that have not done very well. So that's not an automatic indicator anymore of what will work and what won't.
Well, what's coming down the road for independent cinema or non-Hollywood?
Well, the boundaries there are always kind of vague these days. I guess this is considered to be outskirts of Hollywood, as I like to call it. A movie called The Judge with Robert Duvall and Robert Downey Jr., speaking of big names. It's a family estrangement film. Sounds really interesting. Father-son. Duvall plays a judge, and Downey is a lawyer. They've been apart for many years. The son's mother dies. He comes home to the town where the father lives and becomes embroiled in some kind of a legal case involving the old man. So that has some interest.
Well, what makes that one a non-Hollywood? Where is it produced?
Well, I think you look at these things. Where is the money coming from exactly? Who's releasing it? Who's directing it? You know, a lot of these outskirts of Hollywood movies draw big name actors because they simply have a more interesting screenplay than a typical Hollywood movie. It's a chance to really burrow deeply into a more intriguing character. So if you put the right team together, you can make a modestly successful and actually very aesthetically successful film that's not exactly aimed at every multiplex in America. But another interesting thing, indie comedy, St. Vincent with Bill Murray, who has been making a career out of doing these kinds of outskirts of Hollywood movies. Bill Murray plays an old-timer who smokes and drinks and gambles and is deeply in debt to his bank and to loan sharks. He bonds with a single mom living next door, played by Melissa McCarthy. Some people who've seen it describe it as kind of a W.C. Fields type of thing with, you know, he hates kids and there's this kid he has to, you know, take care of. But, of course, he probably softens toward the end and becomes a nice guy.
Yeah, are there any movies where people actually intensify their dislike of kids as they get to know them more?
Well, that could be a nascent genre that we'll see more of in a few years.
All right. And what else from the indie world?
Well, I guess this is, again, kind of borderline indie. John Ridley, a screenwriter and director from Milwaukee roots, came from here. He wrote the screenplay for 12 Years a Slave, got an Oscar. He directed a movie called Jimmy, All Is By My Side, about Jimi Hendrix, the year before Jimi Hendrix really broke big, 1967, I believe. It's focused on that year leading up to the Monterey Pop Festival. I'm really looking forward to this movie in a number of ways. I generally don't like musical biography films because they try to squeeze a whole life into 2 hours. And it always follows the same kind of cut-and-dried pattern, you know, the rise, the stardom, the problem with drink and drugs and women and whatever it is, business partners, and the comeback. Well, here we don't have that. We have the year of a still unknown rising star. Andre Benjamin from Outkast plays Jimi Hendrix. That sounds like good casting. So I'm very much looking forward to it. It was supposed to be released this summer. It's been pushed back. They're now promising a fall release for it.
Is there anything that's not in these two categories?
What about horror movies for Halloween?
All right, yeah.
There are a few of them coming up. There's Annabelle. This is the prequel to The Conjuring. This is the backstory, I guess, about the doll named Annabelle who is somehow at root of all these problems. There's a movie called Honeymoon, starring Rose Leslie from the Game of Thrones TV program, about a honeymoon in a remote rural cabin in the woods that goes horribly wrong, of course.
Yeah, what's going to happen there?
then there's A Girl Walks Home at Night, a vampire western it's been described as. So we have several Halloween movies on the way.
All right. Well, as if that's not enough, is there anything that doesn't even fit into those three categories? Yeah.
Well, it's science fiction.
Okay.
The success of Gravity, you know, has probably once again paved the way for, you know, different kinds of science fiction movies. I believe that this movie, Interstellar, by director Christopher Nolan, was in the works before Gravity made it big, so I'm not going to try to connect the success of one with the inception of another. But it probably will build on the success of Gravity audience-wise. Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway, good stars. It's about, well, interstellar travel. How do you do that? Breaking the laws of physics and all this. Well, wormholes, of course, one of the popular scientific theories of nowadays. Naturally, they find a wormhole somehow and somewhere, and they begin to embark on the journey.
Sounds like a lot of fun stuff this fall. Thanks for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express weekly newspaper, author of its I Hate Hollywood blog, and our regular film contributor. He shared his fall movie preview with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon. One last break, and then our weekly installment of Listening to Mitchell, plus a look ahead to an upcoming concert from the Milwaukee-based Fine Arts Quartet. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Sonia Thompson and Adam Carr are Milwaukee-based artists who work together to create site-specific public art projects. Their most recent is named Listening to Mitchell, and they're sharing audio postcards from the project here on Fridays until the end of September. Here is this week's piece.
Listening to Mitchell is an installation of image and sound that transforms over 50 interviews into an experience of place and its collective memory. The installation is currently on the street, woven through historic Mitchell Street's 7 blocks from the Modjeska to St. Stan's. And throughout its duration, we're sharing the voices and sounds of Mitchell Street here on Lake Effect.
How to mourn.
13 ghosts
we used to sit up in the balcony and the theater would be just jam-packed with kids.
But you know what has changed?
It used to be that people bought one thing and it was quality.
I mean, I remember having shoes that just, you know, wouldn't wear out and you had to go buy shoelaces. Where could you find shoelaces?
Gimbel's used to be here. It used to be, you know, like this is where you would come.
They used to line up. I bet there was 300-400 people waiting to get in.
But they used to have photographers taking pictures of you as you were walking down the street.
So anybody who was getting married, you would see them walking from store to store, trying to find their wedding gown and then, you know, their tux rental and everything else.
78 or 80 early, when we have a Gimbel's here and Sears here and all that, mm-hmm. we've been used to come here for shopping and...
Back in the day, they, you know, you have people with those big boombox radios, you know, so you were hearing, you know, music from different places of the world.
We used to break dance up in the Mission Street because the Magic Rockers.
I used to love to have the windows open and listen to the little carts going by.
We would enjoy the festivals on the street up to a certain hour.
I'd like to see the street come back to it, you know. It'll never be like it used to be. Nothing will be. It remains to be seen what's going to happen.
I mean, it's a beautiful place, but it's definitely, from what I hear, it's changed. It just seems kind of worn down a bit, right? But, you know, if it was fixed up, it could be amazing, amazing, amazing. It's still pretty amazing, though.
Listening to Mitchell is on Mitchell Street from the Majeska to St. Stan's until the end of September. Guides to the installation are available at businesses on Mitchell Street and throughout the city. More information at listeningtomitchell.org. On Sunday, the Milwaukee-based Fine Arts Quartet will play its first concert of the 2014-2015 season. The concert is unique for the quartet because it features a single piece of music, an arrangement of Haydn's The Last Seven Words of Christ. The work is in 9 movements and features a guest soprano along with the quartet, which includes its newest member, violist Juan Miguel Hernandez. The next most recent member, cellist Robert Cohen, and longest-serving member, violinist Ralph Evans, joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio and talked about the challenge of choosing the right person to bring into the group.
To choose somebody to go into a quartet is an extraordinarily difficult thing because there's 4 people married, really, spending more time together than they do with their own wives or husbands. And, you know, to have somebody join that group is emotionally very difficult, and it's also a very precise position to be in because you have to have something about your playing which complements everybody else. It has to be fundamentally have the same kind of thrust, the same idea, the same feelings, so that, you know, they can really fit in. And finding somebody is incredibly difficult. You know, literally scouring the world, listening to everybody and talking to people and getting to know people. And we're very lucky that we found somebody.
Well, and you just went through this.
Well,
yourself.
They went through it with you.
Yeah. So, Ralph, for you, because you are the longest, both of you 32 years, is that right?
Well, I actually came first.
Okay.
I must admit, but he was shortly after.
Shortly. Yeah. So, close enough.
Right, close enough.
So, your 30-year musical marriage has had a long time to mature, but then you had to absorb Robert, you know, and figure that out.
Right.
And now Juan Miguel, musically for you, is it exciting to bring in new blood that way?
I don't know if I would use the word exciting. Challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And
thanks.
No, it is also exciting because variety always makes life interesting and it creates new possibilities and new challenges. But people often ask me, since I've been in the quartet so long, how do you deal with having a new person? And does that upset the musical performances? Does that upset everything, basically? And I think the best answer for this is that quality is the key. When you bring in someone of high quality, it goes fast. You need that talent, that ability, and that experience. And when you bring in someone great, you can create a marvelous new ensemble. For those who are basketball fans, I'll just pick a name. Let's say a LeBron James, probably a household name for sports lovers. These sports figures are often changing teams. If he were to suddenly come on to a new basketball team, I don't think anyone would worry about how he would fit in. Basically, he's so good that people make their adjustments and the team will do just fine in most cases. And the Fine Arts Quartet, because it's had such a long and mostly successful career, if I may say that, it's quite well known in the chamber music world. We have a reputation of quality, and therefore we get top candidates from all over the world. Take Robert, for example. We were so fortunate to get him. I mean, he's one of the world's best cellists as a soloist, and for us it's a blessing to have someone like that who could join us in a chamber music milieu. And it's really not any problem. Of course, there's some adjustments always with any new people, but when you have someone of such high quality, it goes fast.
But if I may add to that, you know, coming from the other side, joining the quartet, this is not just a job. It's not just joining a quartet, you know, a world-class quartet, brilliant players. Here I am being a very good player, wanting to join this quartet. It's not like that at all, because there are 1,000, maybe 10,000 string quartets in the world. There are many that are very high level. Most of them, for me, would have been, well, almost all of them except the Fine Arts Quartet would have been of no interest to join at all. And that's because what the Fine Arts Quartet brings and has in their players is a message in the music, an emotion, a strength of communication that is unique. It brings such warmth and beauty and really strong sense of love and beauty to everything that they play, that was hugely attractive for me to join them, because that's what they did. I mean, I listen to other string quartets, and there are brilliant quartets around, but I can walk away from those concerts and think, well, that was highly professional, it was really, really good, and then I can never remember it again. Whereas when I first heard the Fine Arts Quartet, I'll never forget that performance. And I don't ever forget their performances, because what comes from them is coming from very, very deep inside, and that's what counts in their performances. So as I feel that powerfully about music myself, when the quartet asked me to join them, I felt that that was right. It was the right connection between us, the same sense of what are we doing.
And why?
And why?
Yeah.
And I see that, you know, with Miguel joining the quartet, it's the same thing. Of course, there's going to be, as Ralph says, there's going to be adjustments. You know, I'm still making adjustments 3 years in, and they're still making adjustments to me, I'm sure. But, you know, he has a powerful sense of music making, which is very similar. And I think that makes him the right person. And I think that makes him also want to be a part of the quartet.
We'll talk about this concert on Sunday, because this Haydn piece is monumental and incredibly beautiful. And I did a little research before it came in, and I realized that he himself actually made this quartet arrangement, right?
Yeah.
It was originally fully orchestral with the soprano, and then he himself.
That's right.
Right. I don't know if you would really call it it's an arrangement in the sense that it's for different instrumentation, but that's quite common for composers to do something like that, because they want their music to be performed. Even back in the 18th century, there was no difference. They were eager to get well-known for their works. And we played recently a piece by Saint-Saëns that was written for a rather unusual combination, a gorgeous piece. And he realized that harmonium was one of the instruments, but how often do chamber groups have a harmonium at their fingertips? So he arranged it for a different combination so it would get played. So Haydn was no different. He created that quartet version so that there would be the possibility of more performances. And ultimately, the orchestra version went out of print. I don't know if today that's true, but years ago, you couldn't even get the music for the orchestra version. But the string quartet version was played often enough so that it was still available. And that's the version most people know today.
What are some of the challenges in this piece for a quartet?
Well, I mean, of course, we're doing an arrangement, so to speak, because the way this piece is constructed was originally around the seven last words of Christ. And the idea was that in the ceremony that there would be words spoken, and then Haydn was commissioned to write music that would go into the silences between these words. Then from the quartet version, people started to add some script, some narration, to go words to go between the movements. And then what we're doing is a composer's vision of that, bringing those words into song. So we have Ruth Rosique from Spain coming to sing those lines, and also with the quartet. So it's evolved into a newer kind of piece, in a sense, just more reflective of the original idea. And so the challenges are always connecting voice and strings. That's one thing. And then, of course, because it's a religious piece of music, the challenge is, well, perhaps challenge is the wrong word, but the real sense that you are in a church of music, a church of something, where the performance spans actually a long piece of music. It's over an hour continuously, and it's of such very profound depth, and a lot of the music is very calm and occasionally not so calm. It's interrupted by things, but it's unusual. If you are listening to a Beethoven string quartet, it's constantly changing from one thing to another.
Or even a Haydn string quartet.
Or a Haydn.
Yeah.
Whereas this has longer spans of a kind of senses of a kind of religious occasion. And I think it casts a really different atmosphere, a unique atmosphere on the audience and the whole sense of the occasion. And that's why we decided that it stands alone. It reminds me of Messiaen wrote a quartet for the end of time, which was written in the concentration camp. And it's that kind of sense that here's a huge piece of music that just has to stand on its own. And it can really blow you away.
If I could respond also to that question about the challenges, it consists of 9 movements, 8 of which are slow. That was one of the requirements of the canon or priest who commissioned the work back in 1785. And even Haydn, the great master, was very upset about this, in the sense that he was worried that he couldn't pull it off. I just want to quote one sentence from what Haydn wrote about that. He said, "My composition was subject to these conditions, and it was no easy task to compose 7 adagios lasting 10 minutes each and to succeed one another without fatiguing the listeners. Indeed, I found it quite impossible to confine myself to the appointed limits." Actually, the performers have the same problem. How do you create enough variety in those 7 movements to make it interesting for the public? These movements are all masterpieces. Each one is so gorgeous that it's not really such a big problem. But that is one of the challenges of the work, because of the restrictions placed on the composer when he originally wrote it. Now, do you have time for me just to tell you briefly about the history of how and why we're doing this?
Sure,
piece?
Absolutely.
Okay, it's kind of interesting actually, because we were invited to perform at the Royal Palace in Madrid, and we performed there twice. And what made it exceptional, aside from the fact that we were performing for the king and queen, there's a Royal Stradivarius collection, a Royal Stradivarius quartet collection that Stradivarius gave as a gift around 1700. And those instruments, of course, are under lock and key and are rarely played, but they let these instruments out for us to perform in these concerts. And the director of the series at the Royal Palace was a composer, and after the last concert, he took us out to dinner, and we were sitting around the table, and I was making conversation with him. And, he's a well-known composer in Spain, having studied with Darius Milhaud and Karl Orff. And I said, "Surely you've written some quartets." And he said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I have. But, you know, the piece I'm most proud of is the arrangement I made of Haydn's 7 last words." And I said, "Oh?" So the way that, as Robert mentioned, the way that these pieces, this work is normally played, is you have a quartet and narrator. So the narrator recites in Latin text. The quartet plays a slow movement. narrator continues, quartet plays another slow movement, and so on. He had decided that it might be more interesting, instead of having a narrator, to have a soprano sing the text along with the quartet, instead of having these interludes of narration. It's actually a brilliant idea of his. And so he made this arrangement so there's no narrator, there's no talking, no reciting. It's just all music. And it's very faithful to Haydn, actually. It's not so huge, the differences, but it's just an instrumental changing of the instrumentation along the way. And there was a performance of this for the Pope. And so he said, you know, it would really be great if the Fine Arts Quartet would perform this piece. So I kept this in the back of my mind for a year or two. This was many years ago. And it just never worked out with our scheduling and our concert series, and I kind of forgot about it, to tell you the truth. But then this past summer, we performed with a fantastic Spanish soprano, Ruth Rosique. And suddenly the idea came back, what if we were to do this piece in Milwaukee? It's really a piece that should be done Easter time, to tell you the truth. But the schedule didn't cooperate. And so we all discussed the idea of if we could put on this performance in Milwaukee in September, on our first concert of the year. And by luck, it all worked out. All the pieces of the puzzle worked out. And that's why we are giving this performance, which is the premier performance of this arrangement by Jose Perez in Milwaukee. So yeah. I think it's quite exciting, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And something a little different.
And mm-hmm. It's definitely off the beaten track.
Yeah.
And the composer, who's just had his 90th birthday, is ecstatic. He wrote us a letter. He's so happy that he said, what a birthday present.
Are you going to be able to record it and send him a copy?
Yes. We just went through these arrangements.
Good.
At the last minute, actually. Yeah. But yes.
Terrific. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and taking time today. I really appreciate it. Best of luck starting off this season. And I look forward to having you back in the studio maybe in the spring. We'll talk some more and maybe even play a little bit.
With pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Violinist Ralph Evans and cellist Robert Cohen of the Milwaukee-based Fine Arts Quartet spoke with Bonnie North ahead of their season opening concert this weekend. Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ will be performed Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Zelazo Center for the Arts on the UW-Milwaukee campus. And with that, another week's worth of Lake Effects is in the book. We are produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and yours truly, with production assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Audrey Nowakowski, web assistance from Michelle Matternowski, and studio engineering from John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening. Have a great weekend, and I hope we'll be a part of it. Lake Effect Weekend is Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.